Hello and welcome to the Courtney Turner Radio Hour. It is April 1st, 2024, Monday. We are here on WWCR Worldwide Radio, and it's an honor to spend this hour with you. So I guess this is April Fool's. So I thought for the next hour, I would just say blah, blah, blah. No, I'm just kidding. But you can. I will be filming this, and you will be able to go back and look at it on my website. That is at CourtneyTurner.com. So you can find. I spell it like Courtney. People like to tease me and say Courtney, but that's how I spell my name. It's pronounced Courtney, but CourtneyTurner.com, and you can find all the great ways that you can support my work there. You can support me directly with Give, Send, Go. Buy me coffee. You can do Venmo. It's Courtney. Again, I spell it like Courtney, CourtneyTurney, hash Turner, a Venmo. And then you can also, if you prefer old school snail mail, if you want to write me letters, send me things, or send me financial support that way, you can do so there at 6041 Rural Plains Circle, Suite 110, number 106, Franklin, Tennessee, 37064. I'll read that once more. 6041 Rural Plains Circle, Suite 110, number 106, Franklin, Tennessee, 37064. And then you can also check out some of the great products that we have there, like Magic Dicol, get your Nana Soma, the Relax Sauna. Promo code for your discount is Quartz, and these saunas are really, really awesome. They zip up, they're very small, don't take up much space, and they heat up in a matter of seconds. So you can also add me to your crowd on CrowdRank, and this is kind of like your own Drudge Report, but in a social media form. So I have lots of articles put up there. Go check it out and add me, and we can share news with views you can use. And of course, Element, Stay Salty, RNC, RNC Store / Quartz, promo code Quartz for your discount to get all your B17 to boost your immune system. And so go check out all of that. And any support is greatly appreciated to help me keep spreading the truth. So today I thought I would do a little chat on Tavistock, which is something that I've been studying. Those of you who are familiar with my work, you've probably seen me do several shows on Tavistock. It is something that is of great interest to me. It was definitely a huge kind of catalyst in my own personal, quote unquote, awakening experience. I remember it was back, I think it was in late 2020, and I had a friend, it's always at midnight, you know, who sent me this video, Dr. John Coleman. He said, have you ever seen this? Do you know who he is? And I said, no. And he said, okay, well, you have to watch this and then call me back after you've seen it. So, of course, I did, and it was like 4 or 5 a.m. by the time we finished chatting, and I was so riveted that I ended up getting his books. And the first one that I got, I did not get the physical copy because it was retailing on Amazon for almost $5,000. And so I just downloaded the PDF and I read it 3 times in a week. That's how, consumed I was. So 3 times in a week. And now I believe you can get it for around $30 on Amazon. So this is the Tavistock Institute of Human Relation, Shaping the Moral, Spiritual, Cultural, Political, and Economic Decline of the United States of America. I believe originally he'd also said, and of Great Britain, but this version says of America. And it is by Dr. John Coleman, who was former MI6, and he claims he has lots of access to documents and sources that led to this. His original monograph, I think, was in 1967 or 69, somewhere in the 60s. I might be getting the exact date wrong, but it was late 60s. And he was one of the first to blow the whistle on this institute, the Tavistock Institute. And really, I think part of why I was so intrigued is because they're so instrumental in really social engineering of the masses. So propaganda, also known as brainwashing, right? But really impacting the culture and the narratives that shape our political and cultural milieu, which of course are incredibly powerful in effectuating change and propagating agendas and advancing those agendas. So that's part of why I was so, this is Dr. John Coleman, and he had a speech. It was called the Committee of 300. That was the speech that I heard. I believe you can still find it online, actually, even on YouTube, surprisingly enough. So it really, really just spoke to me because I realized how much I've been lied to about just so much in my life, and just kind of a lot of convergence of so many of my past studies and experiences. You know, I had been seeped very much in my early academic career in philosophy and psychology. And then I was an actress. So that, you know, and so it was kind of, Tavistock has their tentacles everywhere, but it very much just shed a lot of light on things that may not have made as much sense to me previously. So that's personally my experience. There's also, I do recommend for people who are just interested in the subject and looking for books to read, there's Dan Estlin's book, and says Social Engineering the Masses. And interestingly enough, I recently did, I've done a show previously, and I haven't released yet, but I was talking to Patrick Wood, and you know, he's kind of the resident expert on technocracy. And apparently, as early as the 1930s, they define technocracy as the science of social engineering. So you can really see how important Tavistock is to where we are today and where we're going. And just to, because I kind of like to give people the historical context and then, you know, my vision of where I think this is all going. And of course, I don't, you know, I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know the future, but I really have read a lot of the documents, a lot of the books, and a lot of their, what they tell us their future plans are. And as I tell people all the time, it behooves us to take them seriously. When they tell you their plans, they probably mean it. That does not mean that plans can't be derailed. And that is why I like to share this information, because it is my hope that if enough people have the information, then we can be informed, inspired, and empowered to derail their plans. So that is really my hope. And but their plans, and they've talked about it. So they're, and this is why the technocracy is so relevant, but they've talked about how they want to create this AI world society. And, you know, they, of course, we I think most people have heard of the New World Order. They want to create a one world government inside us, a one world socialist government, right? With a one world religion. And it looks like, based on what they're doing with the UN 100, the imagining the world in 2045, which would, of course, be the centennial, the 100th anniversary of the UN. And they're imagining the world then. They're doing this in conjunction with Boston Global Forum. Michael Dukakis, who is the former governor of Massachusetts, has written this book. It's called Remaking the World, the Age of Global Enlightenment. And they're talking about creating a literal AI world society where we will be considered digital citizens, and we are objects. They call us objects. There will be AI citizens. There will be things like digital twins. They are essentially creating what, in my opinion, looks like a cyber Satan. And they want to put us all in this virtual reality. They talk about Ukraine being the central hub of this AI world society, where they did a symposium not too long ago where they said they have to, you know, rebuild Ukraine. It sounds familiar. Build back better. Before you do that, you have to tear it down. And they talk about how it's been decimated by the war. And so they really need us to send lots of aid and money so they can rebuild Ukraine, so it can be this centralized hub of the AI world society. And then it will be connected on this grid to all these other smart cities, C40 cities, 15-minute cities around the world. And that is their future plan. I won't talk too much more about it, but I highly recommend people really look into it. And perhaps I'll do a more extensive show down the road. I will be releasing, I did do a show with Maria Z. She's from Australia. She's doing phenomenal work. And I did an interview with her because she has actually done a 4-part series on this topic. I don't think enough people are really paying attention to it. So all this to say, you know, they are very religious in their sentiment. And, you know, it's this idea that we need to create this one world, centralized governing body. And those who are familiar with the UN, I had done a show maybe 3 months ago now, maybe I'm losing track of the dates, but on the Lucius Truss. And that seems to be the consultancy. It is the consultancy for the UN and seems to be the religious, spiritual underpinnings of the UN. And by the UN, I would say we could also, by extension, say things like other NGOs, like the, you know, World Economic Forum and some of these other, ancillary kind of networks. And so I think it's really important that people have a sense of where they're going, what's driving them. And I think Tavistock is really instrumental to how we get there, because without the conditioning and the social engineering of the masses, you know, these plans will not go into effect. So if you look at what they're doing today, and you can just check out on their website, and I'll get to that, but probably not today. I'm probably going to get right up to when they actually created the Tavistock Institute of Human Relations. But it has a long history prior to that, that a lot of people are not as familiar with. A lot of people know of it now, and I'm so glad that Tavistock is actually on people's radar, but it is because in 2020, there was a whole scandal with the Tavistock Gender Clinic, and then in 2022, it was actually shut down. They had a bunch of lawsuits because they were giving them puberty blockers, and it was very, very controversial. So that kind of put Tavistock on people's radar, but a lot of people don't know the original history of Tavistock, and they don't know that it is a much larger scope than just the transgender clinic. I actually just did, I was on someone's show, and I have that up on my channel. You can check it out. But they have done a lot of work on trans. They were very familiar with the transgender clinic. But when I said, you know, that it was a propaganda bureau, that was quite a surprise. And I don't know that he actually thought I was serious at first. But I was like, oh, no, I'm very serious. It was a propaganda bureau, which we will get to. I will let you know. But I wanted to tell you that what they're doing now, it's very interesting. They talk about how it's an awakening organization and they're recruiting Gnostic Reticulus. So they're, you know, this kind of seemed very reminiscent of the UN 100, where they talk about remaking the age of global enlightenment. That sounds very theosophical, kind of mystical, spiritual, right? And now they're saying Gnostic Reticulus. It also sounds very reminiscent of New Agey, Lucius Truss, which was originally called Lucifer Publishing, by the way. It was the brainchild of Alice Bailey, who was a disciple of Madame Blavatsky, who is very famous for popularizing the New Age movement. And of course, I don't think theosophy began with them. You know, people like Bohm and Boehm were very much, I think, predecessors to the theosophical movement. And I think it way predates them. However, they did popularize it, codify it. And so you can go check out that video that I did. You can go check out their own website where they talk about the Lucius Truss and how it used to be Lucifer Publishing. And of course, because it means the light, which is, I think, modeled after Lucifer, who is the light bearer, the one to illuminate. So we'll get to Tavistock. A lot of people, as I said, start with the 1947 when it became Tavistock Institute of Human Relations, or they started the Wellington House. I like to go a little further back because I think it's really important for people to have context of, you know, how did things, the genesis and how did they start to percolate and what was going on in the time. So I start with Wilhelm Wundt, who is known as the father of psychology. He was the father of experimental psychology. So he had actually one of the first labs. It was very kind of medicalized, and we'll see when we talk about some of his students, and it makes a lot of sense. It really lent itself to what later became kind of Skinnerian, Skinner type of psychology that then got mapped onto education as well. So he was the father of experimental psychology, the founder of the first psychology laboratory. He had a tremendous influence on the development of psychology as a discipline, especially in the United States, although the American father of psychology is typically thought to be William James, who was actually one of his students and one of the first to get a PhD. He granted several very copious PhDs. So he was very prolific. He wrote an estimation of 53,000 pages, including articles on animal and human physiology, poisons, vision, spiritualism, hypnotism, history, and politics. And spiritualism and hypnotism, I had started a series with a friend of mine. Her name is Rachel Wilson. And we actually talked about the origins of the whole field of psychology and spiritualism, hypnotism, mentalism. A lot of alchemical principles were very much they were the influence for the early psychologists. And they were really looking to do things like mind control, mind reading, and it gave a lot of power to the therapist, if you will. So that is interesting. Then Politics, Texts, a Handbook of Medical Physics and Human Physiology, Encyclopedia, Tomes on Linguistics, Logic, Ethics, Religion as a System of Philosophy. And he became the chair of Leipzig, the philosophy chair of Leipzig in 1875. And then in 1879, the university recognized his laboratory as the first one dedicated to psychology. He was the first to really use the term psychology. And I recommend this tiny little book. It's by Klass and Leone, and it is called The Leipzig Connection. And both Charlotte Iserbeet and Anthony Sutton reference this book a lot in talking about the origins of the education movement, because he granted the first PhDs. And so this is a really great book if you want to understand kind of the roots of psychology and history, education. And some of his students were people like this is G. Stanley Hall, who was a mentor to John Dewey, and then who, of course, was very instrumental in exporting the Prussian model of education to the United States. And then Ian Pavlov, this is where we get the Pavlovian method. And this was, of course, also very instrumental in the field of psychology, social science, behavior modification, and unfortunately, education. And then William James, who I had mentioned previously. And I think that there were a couple of other names that I wanted to mention, I don't know if I have them. We'll get to those. But anyhow, so Cattell, who was actually one of the first psychology professors in the United States. And it also, interestingly enough, his grandfather, Wilhelm Wundt's grandfather, was Christian Karl Casimir Wundt, and he was known as Raphael in the Illuminati. So he has a direct connection to the Illuminati, which I think is worth noting. And if you want, to look that up for yourself and verify that, you can find that in the the Illuminati Provincial Report in Utica, September 1782. Then we have in 1886, Freud develops what he calls the talking cure. That's what it was known as. And of course, this became the signature Tavistock method. And of course, Freud was very, very influential to all of Tavistock, to the whole genesis and the entire founding of the field of psychology, him and Jung, of course. And then in 1885, the American Society for Psychical Research was founded. And this is noteworthy because they were also very instrumental in helping to develop the Fabian Society. And of course, the people behind the Wellington House, which later became Tavistock, were mostly Fabian socialists. And the mascot, just a little reminder for y'all, the mascot of the Fabian Society is the tortoise. right? And why? Because they were modeling incrementalism. This was their strategy. And boy, have they really stuck to it. They play the slow, long, steady game, right? Slow and steady wins the race. And their coat of arms is the wolf in sheep's clothing. And I think this speaks very much to the weaponization of the Hegelian dialectic, right? We have these two sides, the target audiences, typically the good cop, bad cop, right arm, left arm. We see this a lot. And those of you who've seen my episodes or listened to me talk about education, I talk about this a lot in that. But I think that that's really the game they're playing. And I think that's very much what the coat of arms, the wolf in sheep's clothing, is speaking to. In September 1909, Freud and Jung visit William James in the United States. And James was a founding member of the American Society for Psychical Research. And Freud and Jung were considered honorary members. Then we have 1914. So Dr. John Coleman actually says it's 1913, but Wikipedia says it's 1914. I wasn't there. I'd have to do a lot more digging to make my assessment of which one's accurate, but I'm gonna go with Dr. John Coleman probably, but Wikipedia does say that it was 1914. And again, there aren't that many people doing research on Tavistock. So there's, you know, I've got a couple of books, and we can talk about, I think if you're watching, you can see one of them by Eric Trist. I've got some of their, like, original books that they wrote, like, not that other people wrote about Tavistock, but I printed this one out. This is, of course, John Rawling Rees, Shaping of Psychiatry by War. We'll get to that one in a bit. But so I have some of their, out of their own words, but there really aren't many people who've done kind of an anthology or an analysis of Tavistock. So I guess we'll trust Dr. John Coleman on that it was in 1913. And 1913 was quite a year, wasn't it now? We had the whole purpose was that there had been a German propaganda bureau. And so, of course, they decided that there needed to be a British propaganda bureau. And so they decided to set this up at the Wellington House, which was, it was known as the British War Propaganda Bureau. And it was at the Buckingham Gate in London. The headquarters were National Insurance Commission before the war. The bureau, which operated under the supervision of the Foreign Office, was mainly directed at foreign targets, including allied nations and neutral countries, especially until 1917 in the United States. The building itself has been demolished, and its former site is now occupied by a block of flats. And then, Wikipedia says in 1914, August 1914, after discovering that Germany had a propaganda agency, it was David Lloyd George, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, who was given the task of setting up the British War Propaganda Bureau. Lord George appointed the writer and fellow Liberal MP, Charles Masterman, to head the organization whose headquarters were set up at the Wellington House, the London headquarters of the National Insurance Commission, of which Masterman was the chairman at the time. And then in September 2nd, 1914, Masterman invited a whole bunch of writers, literary figures, to discuss ways to promote the war interests. And these are very notable figures like Archer, Kane, Doyle, Bennett, Masefield, Chesterton, Newbold, Glassworthy, Hardy, Parker, Trevelyan, and of course, H.G. Wells, a Fabian socialist. And I know they had said that Rudyard Kipling was invited and couldn't attend. And I was devastated to learn that he was a Tavistock asset and a Fabian socialist asset, because I still maintain that the poem If is one of the greatest poems of all time. So, but nonetheless, and they were tasked with writing these, pamphlets and journals and books, all these various literary works, and it was kept secret. And it was, of course, all to create propaganda to garner acquiescence for the Americans and the British people to engage in the First World War. And it was kept secret until 1935. They did not talk about that. And I think it was over 1,600. 1,160 pamphlets that were produced during the war. And then it was Dr. John Coleman. He says that it was the Harmsworth brothers who were tasked with creating this propaganda bureau. And of course, those would be Lord Rothschild and Lord Northcliffe, especially related to the Rothschilds by marriage. And the funding for this, according to Dr. John Coleman, was provided by the British royal family and then later the Rothschilds, who again, Northcliffe was related to through marriage. And then it was Arnold Toynbee who was selected as the Director of Future Studies at the Royal Institute of International Affairs. So this is interesting because that's also known as the Chatham House. And that is essentially like the British deep state epicenter, kind of like our Council on Foreign Relations here in the United States. And he says that they were tasked with this job. And it was Lord Northcliffe, who was the owner of the Daily Times, the Times and the Daily Mail. And he was put in charge of propaganda that was aimed mostly at enemy nations. And then Robert Donald, who was the editor of the Daily Chronicle, was tasked with the propaganda aimed at neutral nations. And following in February of 1918, Lloyd George was accused of creating a new system to gain control over the Fleet Street's leading figures. And then they also had tasked Edward Bernays, who, of course, is the nephew of Sigmund Freud, and his nephew is actually the founder of today's modern propaganda machine, in my opinion, also known as Netflix, and then also Walter Lippmann, to be in charge. They were put in charge by the Tavistock Institute to create propaganda and oversee Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson had ran on the campaign that he would not get us into the First World War. And of course, that was the task at hand. And so they created something called the Creel Commission in 1917. And this was really this major propaganda mission in the United States. And they helped Woodrow Wilson with all sorts of propaganda, not only to create the garner acquiescence for the Americans to engage in the war, because he ran on the campaign that he would not do that. That they later, it was in 1917 when they weaponized the term isolationist. This sound familiar? This weaponization of term. You know, we today hear things like conspiracy theorists, and we know the CIA weaponized that term in document 1035-960, countering the Warren Commission. Well, back then, they weaponized the term isolationist. So they were calling anybody who did not want to engage in the war an isolationist, and they demonized the term. This later resurrected with Roosevelt? And then again, of course, with Ron Paul, right? They, when he was gaining a lot of popularity between the political right, the right populist movement, and they would call him a crazy isolationist. His foreign policy was just too off the wall. We like a lot of his fiscal policies. We just can't do that. And I remember my own father telling me that. So let me see what else I can find. So they also helped Woodrow Wilson, who of course was one of the first, he was one of the first presidents to use the term New World Order. And he was advocating for, he would talk about his book that I think was actually written by Hale, and it was called The New Freedom book, that would talk about how we really needed to have a new world order, a socialist new world order, which of course was a one world a new world order inside a socialist one world government, essentially. And they also demonized terms. They created terms like regime change, collateral damage. These were just some of the propaganda efforts that were done by the Creel Commission. Creel Commission was helmed by George Creel, who later got into a lot of pictorial kind of advertising images, like, you know, the Beat the Promise. That was later again for World War II. World War I, of course, was called the Great War before World War II. And he got into film. He would make these like 4-minute short films, really trying to, target people to enter into the war, both to support the war as well as to, enlist in the war. And then they did some other things that were just lovely, like advising Wilson to sign things like on October 12, 1913, he signed this bill to, quote unquote, adjust tariffs. At least that's how it was phrased. But I think it could be more accurately described as destroying tariffs, which is what Dr. John Coleman says. And I would agree with him. And it eventually led to things like NAFTA, GATT, the World Trade Organization. And this, of course, they said, it was under the propaganda was that we were creating free trade. But really what we were doing was diminishing the tariff revenue in the United States, which was lowering our revenue. But it was also an extension, really, of like the British East Indian British Company, where they were creating back then. It was all of this production out of India. But this is what lends itself to pave the way for what we're experiencing today with all of these essentially sweatshops out of China. And that really kind of started then. And then it was also the federal income tax of 1913. And that was September 15, 1913, because they had to replace the trade tariffs. So this was, in my opinion, a very unconstitutional move. And it was, Wilson called it a fight for the people and for free business. And he was taking part in the completion of a great piece of business. And this propaganda campaign to deceive, the deceptive language around the Federal Reserve Act was conjured up by Walter Lippmann and Edward Bernays. They assisted in garnering that support for the they also set up something called the National Citizens League with Samuel Untermeyer as their chairman to help promote the Federal Reserve Bank, which, by the way, is neither federal nor are there reserves. And we can look at G. Edward Griffin's book, The Creature for Jekyll Island, where he talks about how they literally had a conspiracy on Jekyll Island create this whole Federal Reserve. And this is a quote from Edward Bernays: "Those who manipulate this unseen mechanism of society constitute an invisible government, which is the true ruling power of our country." And that is, of course, from his book, Propaganda. He is known as the father of PR, the father of spin, if you will. I think PR, probably that title really should go to Willie Munzenberg, but he's actually not very much talked about, although Willie Munzenberg was in that initial meeting with Antonio Gramsci, Vladimir Lenin, and Georgi Lukacs, and who else was there? I think it was just them, but you can find this in Antonio Gramsci's grandson's memoirs. He talks about this, how Lenin was very concerned after the Bolshevik Revolution that it didn't spread throughout the West the way that Karl Marx said that it would, and he wanted to know why. And so he held this meeting with Willie Munzenberg, Georgi Lukacs, and Antonio Gramsci. And it was Gramsci who said, because you're looking at this as an economic problem, that there needs to be an economic revolution. And really, this needs to be a cultural infiltration, a cultural revolution. And of course, enter the Frankfurt School and Tavistock. And they took on that mission very seriously. We'll talk about how they did that. So, It was uh, that was Then we get, it was in 1928 that he wrote that book on propaganda. So in 1920, we have the Tavistock Clinic, and they saw their first patient, a child, September 27, 1920. Its name was taken from the original location at 51 Tavistock Square. And then by the end of the 1920s, the building on Tavistock Square was no longer big enough. So John Rawling Reese, who had been deputy director, since 1926, established an extension fund called the Tavistock Institute of Medical Psychology to raise money for new premises. And on August 9th of 1929, it was formally incorporated. So John Rawling Reese, who I had just shown you, he wrote that book, Shaping the Psychiatry of War, Shaping of Psychiatry by War. And he created this, what was known as the Tavistock Method. He said it would induce and control stress by what he calls psychologically controlled environment in order to make people give up firmly held beliefs under peer pressure. He also went on later to become the co-founder of the World Federation for Mental Health in 1948. He was the deputy director in 1932. He proclaimed, we can therefore justifiably stress our particular point of view with regard to the proper development of the human psyche, even though our knowledge may be incomplete. Our knowledge is incomplete. That's okay. We won't worry about that. We must aim to make it permeate every educational activity in our national life. Then he goes on to say, let me see if I can find this quote from him, because I think it kind of sums up a lot of who he is. He says, public life and politics and industry should all of them be within our sphere of influence. If we are to infiltrate the professional and social activities of other people, I think we must imitate the totalitarians and organize some kind of fifth column activity. If better ideas on mental health are to progress and spread, as we, as the salesmen, must lose our identity, let us all, therefore, very secretly be fifth columnists. And I don't have the exact quote here, but he had talked about the spheres of, he had talked about the spheres of education and what was the other one? That would be most easy to do. But of course, those who are familiar with Gramsci, he talks about the five pillars of society. So it's religious, the education, law, media, right? Media, entertainment, and what was the other one? Family, of course, the family must infiltrate and tear down the family, which they were very intent on doing. So then we get to John Rawlings Reese, the Tavistock Institute of Medical Psychology, John Rawlings Reese, Henry Dix, Ronald Hargraves, Tammy Wilson, and Wilfred Bion. And Wilfred Bion is very instrumental, as we'll see later, in developing group therapy dynamics. Later, all of his works are the inspiration to create the A.K. Rice Institute. And the A.K. Rice Institute is kind of like the American offshoot of Tavistock in the United States. So we then have in 1921, the Marquis of Tavistock, A.K.A. the Duke of Tavistock, donates a building for shell shock therapy research. And he was Herbrand Arthur Russell, and he was related to William Huntington Russell, who was the co-founder of Skull and Bones in 1832. The other one was Alfonso Taft, who, of course, is related to President Taft, who are founders of. And we were talking before about G. Stanley Gilman. There was a lot of contact with him and G. Stanley Hall, who was Granville Stanley Hall, but he was also very much tied to Gilman, Daniel Coit Gilman, who was And so that whole Leipzig connection, who was very instrumental, and he was the one who was tasked in creating the Russell Trust, which became the Skull and Bones, essentially. So we have William Huntington Russell was also Order of St. John, Knights of Grace, Order of Garter, Order of the Antish Empire, and Fellow Royal Society. Then we have Bowlby and Sargent were conducting very similar research at the Maudsley Hospital under Mapother Institute of Psychiatry. They were doing insulin shock therapy. And so this was interesting because Bowlby was friends with Julian Huxley, who we know is one of the forerunners of UNESCO. He coined the term transhumanism in 1957. And although I'm hearing now that Max Moore likes to take credit for that one now, he was also part of the Eugenics League, the eugenics organization, the British Eugenics Society. He was the League of Nations, and he also later wrote the biography of Darwin. So this was so it's interesting also because the shell shock therapy research that was initially done at this Tavistock medical clinic was, you know, they were under the guise of doing research on post-traumatic stress disorder and trying to help the soldiers, really. And then later they decide that they're going to study the breaking points of the soldiers, and they would now be able to create essentially trauma-based mind control. But they talk about how now they're able to create the shell shock therapy. And this was a term that was coined shock doctrine. So they went from studying and wanting to assist soldiers who had shell shock therapy and post-traumatic stress disorder to creating shock doctrine, which of course got very much weaponized against the masses. Then we have Kurt Lewin in 1922, and he was a refugee of the Frankfurt School in Germany, and he became the director of Tavistock in 1922. He also set up the Harvard Psychology Clinic that originated the propaganda campaign to turn the American public against Germany and involve us in World War II. And he was also known as the father of social psychology, organizational and applied psychology. He created the Center for Group Dynamics at MIT. He was also instrumental in creating the National Training Labs, and then in Michigan, the Institute for Social Research. And this is where they were doing, the National Training Labs is where they were doing a lot of what they call a sensitivity training. You may have heard this more recently. A lot of corporations have taken this on. This is not a coincidence at all. This is a lot of organizational psychology comes out of, it was born out of Tavistock. And this is why corporations are taking on so many of these tactics, this language, the modalities of the group dynamics that was learned then. But then they actually, when they didn't call it sensitivity training, they actually called it brainwashing. They were much more honest back then, I think. But that is what it was, and that is what it is, in my opinion, still today. And so he was also a proponent of Gestalt therapy. And this was kind of the forerunner to a lot of like the landmark group kind of therapy trainings that became very popular. And there are lots of offshoots of them. I've actually done two. And, you know, there's things to be gained from it, but it's definitely a kind of like communist propaganda machine for sure. Every time you entered the room and every time you left, they would have you hold hands and sing the song Imagine. John Lennon. And it's very much about you make yourself incredibly vulnerable. And this is part of the group dynamics tactic. And then they have a lot of leverage over you because you've now shared your innermost secrets with them. And this is, of course, the genesis and the potential lever of power for things like blackmail and you know, because they have some sort of, or bribery, they have some sort of control over you because you know so much. And this all means stripping your own your own identity. Then we have 1934. John Rawling Rees pulls off a PR coup by successfully obtaining royal patronage from the Duke of Kent. And this patronage represented the Tavistock arrival on the medical and social scene. And Tavistock Clinic, it started in the 1930s with the 7 doctors, 249 patients, and there were 90, and then in 1939, there were 90 doctors and 1,811 patients, with the adults department alone seeing 26,500 appointments in just the first half of the year. And then I think it's worth noting that in 1935, we had the psychology of radio. This was with Hadley Cantrill, and it was the Harvard psychologist Gordon Alport who co-authored what was called the psychology of radio. And then Alport would later lead the charge for the U.S. Tavistock Institute. And he worked with Cantrill in 1937, who was a member of the Rockefeller Foundation, funded Office of Radio Research at Princeton University, established a study to study the influence of radio on different groups of listeners. Cantrill was Nelson Rockefeller's roommate at Dartmouth. And then in 1940, Cantrill authored The Invasion from Mars, a study on the psychology of panic regarding the radio broadcast of H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds. So they also then later, it was Fred Emery, who was a Australian psychologist who worked with Tavistock. He ended up working on a hypothesis on the psychology of television. And then I probably don't need to tell you that today they're very involved in the psychology of film, really just all media and ways that they can use it for the military term would be operational preparation of the environment, also known as predictive programming. Then it was in the 1930s, I think it was September 1939. Of course, that was when Hitler's tanks rolled in on September 1st into Poland and World War II begins. And the Tavistock Clinic was actually evacuated to Westfield Women's College in Hampstead during the war. A number of the women took charge. These included Mary Luff, Jane Isabel Sooty, some other names I'm not that familiar with. But John Rawling Rees became the consultant to the psychiatrist, the army at home, responsible for mental health of approximately 3 million people. Many key figures from Tavistock Clinic joined him in the army, becoming what was known as the Invisible College. I thought that was quite a very appropriate name. Together, they were responsible for a range of important innovations. Selection processes were restructured to keep people who would be prone to breaking down away from active duty. Wilfred Bion developed his famous leaderless group to revolutionize the process of officer selection. The Invisible College worked on training and morale, the interrogation of prisoners, propaganda for the enemy, and clinical support for the army. Bion, again, with the help of John Rickman, investigated a major piece of work supporting returning soldiers and prisoners of war, known as the Northfield Experiment. It was short-lived, but it became the basis of the future group work and therapeutic community. And then at the end of the war, key figures of this Invisible College played a role in the denazification of Germany, helping to select new members of the government and administration and promoting democratic process. And it was during the Second World War, 44 staff members of Tavistock Clinic, including 20 senior staff, were called up into active duty as World War II came to an end and staff began to think about the future. And it was in 1945 that under Bion's leadership, Operation Phoenix was put into action. New staff were co-opted from the military, particularly those who had worked on with the War Office Selection Board. War Office Selection Board became very utilized later. This was very much instrumental in the creation of the OSS, and then, you know, later really just the entire military-industrial complex. These included Eric Trist, father of Alan Trist, who is also the producer of The Grateful Dead, and then John Sutherland, also known as Jock Sutherland, followed by John Bowlby. And Bowlby was very famous for those attachment theory studies where, you know, they had left the children he did a lot of his research on attachment theory, which we can talk about later. Bion initiated one of the most dynamic phases of Tavistock's history. And then we get to 1946 and 1948. During the war, Bion's colleagues began to take a look at social organization. And this is really kind of the where we get into organizational psychology, Operation Research, which I have one of their original books, Operation Research. And this is what's led to this, you know, public-private partnerships that we're seeing today. Tavistock really created that model, or they were very instrumental in helping to execute that model. So once back at Tavistock Clinic, he created a study group on dynamics that included John Rickman, John Sutherland. In 1946, this work gave birth to a new organization, the Tavistock Institute of Human Relations. So this is where we come to the Tavistock Institute of Human Relations that people know about today. It was created in part with funding from the Rockefeller Foundation. It pioneered a multidisciplinary and integrative approach to the behavioral sciences in relation to the workplace. The two organizations worked very closely together, sharing the same staff and same building. So let me see. I think there might be a couple of other things I want to include before we wrap up. I think the next time I'll go into the Tavistock Institute of Human Relations and their early days once they officially formed, and then up to where we are today. And they're very instrumental in shaping a lot of the current milieu that we are in at the moment. So I remember there was one other thing I wanted to mention. Back in 1937, there was a decision that was made. They had a board meeting, and I read this in a couple of sources, but Dr. John Coleman definitely talks about this. And they decided that they were going to use Oswald Spengler's work, the translation is The Decline of Western Civilization, as kind of the model for the Tavistock Institute. And this is how he summarized it. He said that alien elements would be introduced into Western civilization in increasing numbers, and the West would fail at that time to expel the alien, thereby sealing its fate, a society whose inward beliefs and sound convictions would become at variance with its outward profession, and thus Western civilization would fall by the wayside in a matter of the ancient civilizations of Greece and Rome. Tavistock thinking was that Spengler had indoctrinated the Western civilization to believe that it would err on the side of Roman civilization and expel the alien. Then he goes on to say that the genetic loss had fallen upon Europe, especially Scandinavian, England, Germany, it was already so great beyond the expectations, and it continued. But this is really what they were, you know, this is their eugenics kind of mindset. And so they really were, they were saying that instead of what Spengler had said was that it would fall, that they were going to create their own, instead of letting it fall and then have, you know, what happens happens, but that they were going to create essentially a new world order as a means of ushering in with their new plan. And then there were previously, before that, one of the inspirations was Corea Moylan Walsh, and the book was The Climax of Civilization. That was in 1917. And this was a meeting with at the Wellington House. Board members Rothmere, Northcliffe, Lippmann, and Bernese had proposed using that as their guide. And that was very much a Malthusian type of mindset that, you know, later was espoused by people like the Club of Rome, right? The Limits of Growth document. So I wanted to mention that because I think it's important to understand the mindset of the people and some of the influences. And then here's a quote from Edward Bernese. He says that if we are to understand the mechanisms and motives of the group mind, it is now possible to control and regiment the masses according to our will without them knowing it. And of course, he talks about, you know, the invisible government. And then he says engineering consent. So if you'll remember, he advised part of his advising to Woodrow Wilson was about polling, and they call that manufacturing consent, public consent. If you can influence the leader, either with or without their consensus cooperation, you automatically influence the group with which they sway. He called this technique opinion making. And then I also wanted to mention that Lewin and his team founded the Stanford Research Center, and this will later see the Changing Images of Man is a Stanford Research document that was very instrumental in shaping a lot of the beliefs of, you know, out of Tavistock. The center, the Stanford Research Center, MIT, and the National Institute of Mental Health were just amongst some of the. So I think that we might wrap it up there. I did want to mention that the that earlier quote that I had read from Reese was from the meeting of the National Council for Mental Hygiene in the UK, the strategic planning for mental health, but hygiene seems to be code word for eugenics oftentimes. So anyhow, yes, next time we will, oh, this was the one other one, was that the In 1933, Rockefeller Foundation President Max Mason assured the Rockefeller financiers that their program, the social sciences, will concern themselves with rationalization of social control, the control of human behavior. So I think that kind of sums it up. They are studying human nature, studying human psyche, so that they will be equipped to be the ones to control it and to socially engineer the masses. So I hope that was informative. I will definitely, there's a lot more to cover, so we'll definitely keep going with this. I'm going to be doing a series on Tavistock with Badlands Media. I'm actually going to be recording the first of that this weekend. And you can find all of my work at CourtneyTurner.com. That is CourtneyTurner.com. And I appreciate any support, really, to keep going. Because this is incredibly time-consuming and exhaustive of resources. So if you enjoy and appreciate the work I'm doing, then any support is really greatly appreciated. And of course, you can go and find all of my podcast platforms, my social media platforms, and liking, sharing, subscribing helps me as well. So thank you so much for watching and listening.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.